This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Everybody, welcome to the Jeff Rubin Show. I am Jeff Rubin, and joining me today on the Skype on my phone is Alexis Wellwood, who has just completed a book on the word more. A book on the word more, M-O-R-E. Alexis, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, you're an etymologist. Am I using that word correctly? You study words, right? That's how this came to be.
You know, this is what people would usually think. If you're studying the meaning of a word, you must be an expert in etymology. But I'm actually a philosopher and a linguist.
Oh, okay.
I study something a little broader, language itself.
But. What's the difference between an etymologist and a linguist? Linguists study, I mean, I guess you just told me, linguists study language, whereas etymologists study individual words?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not an expert in etymologists either, but etymologists usually, we would say, study the historical trajectory of a word, how words maybe shared between languages, how they develop over time as languages change, how they come to take on new shades of meaning, things like that. So they're really feeding into, you know, what you kind of see in a dictionary entry. Linguists study language, the nature of language, the capacity for language. So language is something which gives birth to words, or so it seems. That's just, you know, that sort of individual level study for an etymologist is pretty much the end of the story, whereas a linguist will use case studies of particular words to understand something deeper, more fundamental about language.
When did this first become an interest to you? Like, when did you decide this was what you were going to study? And not, I don't mean the word more, but just language.
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting. I was gearing up to be a radical leftist political activist living on the west coast of Canada when moving to Montreal caught my fancy. So I moved to Montreal and I started studying at Concordia University. And there was a course listing for something called Language and Mind, the Chomskyan program. And I was like, oh, right, Chomsky's a linguist. Like, I wonder what that's about. So I took that class and just I had an amazing professor who got me to appreciate there's this whole world of study of language that just fascinated me. So that's kind of the initial start.
What is that about, that Chomsky is a linguist? Because I gotta say, that is like kind of all I know about linguists, is that Noam Chomsky was a linguist. So Noam Chomsky, first of all, who is Noam Chomsky?
Is.
If you were like a political, if you were involved in like leftist politics, is that how you initially came to him? Can you briefly describe who Chomsky is so I don't embarrass myself doing it?
Yeah, I could give it a shot. So Noam Chomsky, I think he just celebrated his 90th birthday, is an extraordinarily prolific thinker and writer. He's written, I think it's fair to say, hundreds of books, but at least 100 books, both in sort of political science, broadly speaking, and linguistics. And his work has just been hugely impactful in the foundations of computer science, cognitive science, all sorts of adjacent fields.
I guess like his influence has been wide, and it's been in politics and, like you said, computer science, but he is a linguist, I guess, in training, like at its core. Like, how does that interact with these other things? What did he do as a linguist?
Yeah, so he got his start at MIT in the 50s, and there he was trying to teach, I think, at least this is the way the story is handed down, you know, trying to teach mathematicians and engineers about the study of language. And what he did during that time was show how you could take sort of abstract models from basically from computer science and use those to model the what we call the generative capacity of language. So if you look at sentence structure, which is what he was primarily focused on, he wanted to know how is it possible that we seem to be able to produce and understand sentences that we've never heard before and that don't seem to be bounded in terms of their complexity, right? So think of the longest sentence you can, you know, add another clause and it's again, an even longer sentence. So we basically wanted to figure out how you could model what that knowledge looks like, what it is in each of our heads that allows us to do this, that actually underwrites the capacity to produce and understand sentences of unbounded complexity. And that initial investigation basically led to what was called the cognitive revolution in psychology, basically thinking about the mind as some kind of computational system that has recursive rules for the generation of structures like this, sentence structures. So that was sort of it in the beginning, and that pioneered a new field that was called generative linguistics, which differed from what came before, which was primarily like if you asked what is linguistics prior to Chomsky, it'd be fair to say it's, well, linguists go and they find languages that people haven't written a grammar of, and they sort of describe the language. Here's what sounds are in the language. Here are the little pieces that make up words. Here's how words go into sentences. And there's just sort of a description of the language. Chomsky really shifted the discussion under the banner of generative linguistics to thinking about the rules and representations that underlie people's knowledge of language. So it's sort of a deeper theoretical study, in fact, a scientific study, rather than just, I shouldn't say that writing grammars down isn't scientific, but it's descriptive, whereas Chomsky wanted to understand why are humans even capable of doing these things that, say, we want to write grammars about, right? What is it that we're actually doing when we produce and understand language? And in particular, how did we learn how to do that? Did we learn how to do it?
So it connects to computers because he is treating our brain and the fact that we're able to do this thing that I am currently doing right now as I speak this sentence without even thinking about it. And like, how do we do that? And is there any learnings that we can apply to computer science from that? Am I describing that correctly? Did I get it?
Yeah, something like that. The dominant idea that developed in the 20th century in cognitive psychology is basically that, if you want to understand how the mind works and, eventually the relationship between the mind and the brain, it's useful at least to think about the mind as something like an information processing device, which is exactly what a computer is. So it's something that takes inputs of various sorts. Like when you're talking about a computer, it might be like keystrokes, or if you're using your mouse, like mouse drags or something like that. And it transforms them into something else. Writing a Word document or painting a picture in Photoshop or who knows, something like that. So for example, you can think about how does the mind do vision, right? How do we see? We know if you look at the sort of physical properties of the eye that what you get is actually just, kind of an array, some kind of map of photons hitting a two-dimensional surface. But that's not what we experience in the world, right? We experience a world in three dimensions. So how is it that the body takes in a two-dimensional array of information about light and transforms that into an experience of three-dimensional objects? So it's okay, so that's sort of a scientific question you might ask in vision science, and it's been found useful to think about it as a series of computations that right. Your brain performs, and language is the same way.
So I have one more question about Chomsky, and then we can move on from the ancient history stuff, but I guess the politics is just something he's so associated with. Is there a connection between the language and the politics, or is that just like an interest he had and that's another thing he does?
He's always asked that question, and he always, as far as I am aware, he usually refuses to answer it. And I've kind of wondered why, because it seems to me there is a connection there. But now this is just me kind of speculating, not a scholar of Chomsky's political writings at all. But I understand, he's radically humanist. He's really interested in human rights protecting, the weak from the strong and so on in terms of nation states and the people that they, the people that inhabit them. So there's something sort of very human and even individualistic, caring about individuals in the world. And his approach to language has a lot of properties that locate the study of language at the individual as well. So we're studying properties of individual mind brains, that's how we'd say it, rather than what people usually think of and what people predominantly thought of language before his writing became so influential, namely that language is just some kind of like social artifact or something. It's whatever you find in books, you know.
So I can imagine you're in this class about language. I'm starting to hear how this starts to interest you. Like, when does it go from, oh, this is a class I took, to like, oh, this is something I'm going to take really seriously and, you know, study seriously?
I think it was when I took my first class in syntax. So syntax is the study of how words go together to make sentences. I can give you an example of what syntax studies by giving you a pair of sentences, actually famous examples from Chomsky going back to the 50s or 60s. So if I say something like, colorless green ideas sleep furiously, you know, you might not have, you know that that can't be describing anything true or whatever, but you can tell that what I spoke was English. Versus if I say, furiously sleep ideas green colorless, you know that I've spoken some English words, but what I've not done is uttered a sentence. Syntax studies, you know, what are the rules for putting words together into sentences in a language?
And those are rules, like, it's the rules are like, no one wrote down the rules, like, the rules are emerged organically, and then it's up to linguists to, like, work backwards and figure out, all right, what are the rules that people seem to be agreeing on here, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, sometimes groups of people get together and they want to act like they can say and tell everybody what the rules are and how to follow them and so on. So there's this thing called the Académie Française, for example, in France, which writes down the official rules of French, et cetera. But they're just, you know, these are just grammar Nazis. I don't know, how do you put that in a less terrible way? But, right, these are people like who are just pushing back against a tide, right? Language is something that's natural to human beings, that emerges practically spontaneously in children without any explicit instruction. And it's not the case that those four-year-olds are like reading books on grammar in order to learn English, right? They're sort of absorbing the rules from the environment or something like that, right? Yeah, absolutely. We make the rules, but not consciously. It's something about being human, something about human biology rather than anything else. And indeed, so linguists, what they're doing is trying to discover what those rules are, right, and how they got to be there, rather than just sort of like, you know, just maybe making a guess as to what they might be, writing down a grammar or something like that.
So all this interest in language and how these words string together, but then you do end up studying one specific word more. How did you end up, like, what kind of started you down that path?
So I had this kind of like baby research position, a one-year research position at the University of Maryland in the Cognitive Neuroscience of Language Lab. And really, I was there to just talk to everybody, see what they were working on, see what I was interested in, see what I wanted to get involved with. And it happened that I'd learned some stuff about comparative sentences. So comparative sentences are things like, Anne drank more coffee than Bill did, so there's more. I'd learned a little bit about those types of sentences, studying sentence meaning during my BA studies. But when I got to Maryland, there were a couple of different research groups that were interested in questions related to comparatives that really caught my attention. So one of them concerns something called comparative illusions, which actually I have a paper out on this last year. It's called like The Anatomy of a Comparative Illusion. And that represented about 10 years of eventually this project developing into something that we could publish in the Journal of Semantics. But what this was looking at was an interesting case of mismatch between what sounds like a perfectly acceptable sentence of English, perfectly natural sentence, something that follows these implicit rules, but upon closer reflection doesn't seem to have any meaning. And this is extremely exotic. We don't run into this all the time. So let me give you an example. So what we do is say something like, okay, I'm going to give you a sentence and I want you to tell me whether you think it sounds like a good natural sentence of your language. Okay, ready?
Okay.
Okay. More Americans have been to Russia than I have.
Sounds okay. I'll sign off on that one.
Sounds great. Okay. So what does it mean? More Americans have been to Russia than I have.
The number of Americans, well, more Americans have been to Russia than you have. I guess I don't know what it means. I mean, I guess you're saying that you're just one person and more than one person has gone to Russia.
Yeah, so that's one thing that people say. Indeed, you know, you might feel like, but maybe that's what it means now. But then, you know, say it to yourself a couple more times, you'll think, well, maybe it has to do with how many times people have been or goings to Russia there are, etc. Anyway, the thing doesn't actually have any meaning. It's any of these things that you might take as a sort of stab at what it means, giving these sorts of paraphrases, eventually you realize those are sort of thoughts that are adjacent to the sentence, but the sentence doesn't actually seem to have a stable interpretation.
Where are these sentences coming from? Like these nonsensical sentences, like you talk about them like you're discovering them like a mineral in the earth. Like who wrote that sentence and then like put it on the wall and scratched their chin and was like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. I mean, this is just indeed what linguists do often. You know, once we think we've got the rule, let's make up some sentence and that we think maybe would violate the sentence and see does it also seem to follow the rules or not. This one, the comparative illusion sentence, was reported by a linguist in his dissertation, his doctoral thesis in 1984, I think it was, Monal Betty, and he attributed it just to one of his colleagues in graduate school. But yeah, we do this. We kind of collect these little butterflies, you know, these like strange language examples.
That's almost like a famous sentence, almost like a famous math equation or something that someone came up with, what'd you say, like 35 years ago and has sort of stuck around. And it seems like it'd be easy to sort of construct a nonsense sentence like that one. But I guess this one is so well constructed and it did get me at first. And you have to kind of really think about like where are the places where it doesn't make sense. So this is like actually more difficult to construct than it initially seems, right? Like, and that's why we're still using this one example from 35 years ago. Is that all right?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, no, that sounds right. And really what we do in our paper is we just, you know, we take sentences that are similar to it. So we construct variants on that sentence, which are perfectly grammatical and, you know, so they follow the rules and they're perfectly meaningful. So for example, more Americans have been to Russia than Canadians have. No, there's nothing problematic about that sentence, right? It just means the number of Americans who've been is greater than the number of Canadians who've been. No problem. Something seems to go wrong when you change out Canadians for I or whatever. So, you know, we just kind of play around with the different linguistic features of the sentence and see under what conditions does this kind of phenomena arise? Under what conditions are people fooled into thinking it's good despite being meaningless ultimately. But yeah, absolutely. This is a kind of methodology that we engage in all the time. Somebody stumbles into or utters a sentence that upon reflection is extremely puzzling, and then we kind of stare at it for decades. Like, yeah.
Were there other books about specific words that you saw that kind of made you think, is there a word I should be studying?
Oh, no. It's actually a joke so I'm in a philosophy department, but I'm trained as a linguist, where when you meet a philosopher, and you know, you say that you're a linguist, they'll be like, "Oh, what word do you work on?" But it's we think it's a joke. Like, well, you don't work on some particular word, but then you know, here I am, and the word is more. So no, I came into the study because along with comparative illusions, other studies involving the structure and meaning of sentences like these ones came onto my plate, as well as studies in language acquisition. So how children learn how to hook up these sentences with their thoughts or their perceptions and concepts of the world. And so basically it turns out that there is so much known from a number of different fields, linguistics, philosophy of language, cognitive psychology, cognitive development, etc., about these sorts of sentences, because the kinds of meanings they express, you know, comparisons of quantities and so on, are really, really important for all different kinds of aspects of human experience, actually. So for me, I'm doing it. The book is about a detailed study of how sentences like these are constructed and what they mean, both in English and in other languages, and then as well as how that detailed study and what you learn from a detailed study like that hooks up with all these other things that are known about, say, human cognition and perception.
So I've been using adjectives, and I don't want to brag, but the word more for, you know, most of my life, as far back as I can remember. What are like, what do I not know about the word more and how it's used? You know, like what am I not recognizing about it?
you know, we, as users of a language, right, as competent speakers, perhaps even above average competency in terms of performance, right? You have a podcast, so, you know, you're good with language.
I speak words good, yeah.
You speak words good, exactly. And, you know, I'm a professor. I kind of have to do that, too. But, you know, language is like the easiest thing that comes to us. It's like the most natural thing for human beings. Not all, right? I mean, there are sometimes pathologies that, you know, prevent people from being able to speak. By the way, I should mention that when I talk about language, I mean spoken or signed, right? So sign languages are full-blooded human languages. So I don't mean to exclude them when I talk about speaking with sound.
When we're talking about more, do we mean the word more as like, you know, or the equivalent that you use to compare quantities in all languages? Or is there something specific about the word, the English word more?
No, when I'm talking about more, yeah, that's really just some kind of gloss on it because we're speaking English. I think, well, I mean, just descriptively, you look at Spanish, they have más that functions, I would argue, exactly the same way as English more. In French, they have plus. In Romanian, they have mai. And then, you know, lots and lots and lots of human languages have an analog of more. It's pronounced differently. But once you do your deep dive into the syntax and semantics of it, it's exactly the same. So you find, here's what you end up seeing. You end up seeing that this expression, more, in English, it performs a highly abstract general function across a wide variety of conceptual domains. And this highly abstract function is very, very specific. It's very, very, it's hard to describe until you do this analysis and you have these formal tools that you can avail yourself of. But it's highly abstract, it's highly specific. And a couple of things that you can note, indeed, is that nobody ever taught you that that's what it means. In fact, your parents wouldn't have a very easy time saying what it means. The same thing occurs in language after language after language with exactly the same meaning and the same sort of distribution, the same highly abstract and specific function. I guess that's what you might not see just thinking about it, you know, like comfortable using the language. You must have learned the language when you were a kid. English is totally different from Spanish, etc. But in fact, the detailed of an expression like this will end up revealing to you there's a very high degree of uniformity both within and across languages in terms of how our ideas and thoughts are expressed through language.
Are there languages where the equivalent of more is just totally different? It works in like a totally different paradigm I wouldn't even understand.
No. Interestingly, there is a difference. So I was trying to be cautious, right, in saying like in many languages, kind of trying to avoid most languages, but because who knows, actually. We haven't studied every single language that exists, right? And I could actually say something that would make it impossible. That is, if there's a language per person, it would probably be impossible to study all the languages. But there is a difference between English-type languages and a different sort of language, which just doesn't have a word like more at all. And this is quite interesting. So, for example, we say something like, Jeff is more intelligent than Alexis. And here's one thing that we can notice about.
I don't think anyone listening to this podcast is going to say that, but continue.
Doesn't have to be true, right? I mean, but, you know, we could say it, we know what it means, and we know what it means, and then we could say, well, true or false, right? One thing we can notice about our understanding of that sentence is that it does not imply. So if it's true that Jeff is more intelligent than Alexis, it doesn't necessarily follow that Jeff is intelligent. Right? Could we agree on that?
Right.
Now, but if we say in English, Jeff is intelligent, Alexis isn't, that would imply that Jeff is intelligent, right? You just said that. Like, right? Okay. So that's a kind of pattern that you can observe in English. Now, if you go to another language that doesn't have the word more, and so can't construct a sentence like Jeff is more intelligent than Alexis, what you find very often that these languages do is they'll construct a sentence very much like the Jeff is intelligent, Alexis isn't. So Jeff, you know, the adjective is true of Jeff, the adjective is not true of Alexis, that's what it looks like to us. However, what it means is pretty much the same thing we mean by the more sentence, and it doesn't imply that Jeff is intelligent. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually something that's bugging me a little bit right now. What you seem to have are very different structures, different words, but pretty similar thoughts being expressed by the two sentences. This is something I'm thinking about right now. Like, I don't want it to be the case that you can do more wherever you want without actually having all the fancy stuff that I think more involves.
Especially like tuned to the word in the same way that like if someone says my name in a crowd, I'll turn around and it'll kind of jump out. Are you especially tuned? Do you hear people using the word more all the time now?
Oh yeah, no, totally. And I have been for years. Like, I'm still, you know, the book's coming out next month or whatever, and I've been working on it for a couple of years. You know, I saw just a couple days ago, there's a Verizon ad that has more written really big, and then it says is less, right? So the ad is more is less. And yeah, that'll kind of be like, that'll grab my attention, and I'll be thinking about that for a while. I've gotten over talking to whoever's around about it all the time, but yeah, no, absolutely. That's actually a way that linguists often will come up with examples that'll help test their theory. In fact, like, you just get tuned to something and then you notice it in the wild, as we say, and you might learn things like, oh, like, turns out like people can use more to do stuff that I didn't realize they could do. I don't know, like when they say something like, he's more intelligent than, or no, his words were smarter than they were weighty or something, like comparing very different dimensions, you know, things like that. So you hear people saying things like this, and you wonder what they mean, and you wonder whether your theory can accommodate them, et cetera. I mean, the more
can,
is
can
less.
I try an example?
Yeah, for sure.
From the American 80s rock band Extreme, I love you more than words. Is that a different use of the word more? Like, is that a poetry thing, or is that make it different in any way?
Oh, see, that's a great example. It's a great example because on the face of it, it's actually problematic for some things that we might want to say about the requirements on more. So I love you more than words would seem like it means like the degree to which I love you is greater than how many words there are.
I guess actually I love you more than words just to kind of give everyone some context for what we're talking about. But the song is just more than words, or maybe more than a feeling by Boston would be another good example. You know, like, yeah. I don't know. Like, it's like, feel it. I don't know. What is the word? I don't know. Do you look at like lyrics and poetry, like, you know, the rock band Boston, when you're studying a word?
Well, it's interesting. I don't so much. Some do for sure. But a lot of linguists, myself included, I think maybe part of the reason we were interested in the game in the first place is that it allows for our own creative expression of language. So, you know, before I switched over to linguistics, I was actually studying creative writing and Latin American studies. And I wanted to be a poet, and I was particularly interested in poetry that sort of broke language, that seemed to break the rules. And that's probably why, when I realized, whoa, there are these rules to be broken and nobody wrote the rules down, et cetera, you know, it was particularly fascinating. So I don't so much, but I want to say about the particular example that you were giving there, so more than words versus more than a feeling, there's this kind of phenomena where people think that, you know, you can more or less pick whatever, you know, particular words you want, as long as they're more or less synonymous to describe the same sort of thing. And the case of more shows us that that's really not quite true. So, for example, I don't know, suppose you have like, suppose there are 5 cups of milk on the table, okay, and 3 of them are yours and 2 of them are mine. And suppose that my 2 cups are way bigger than yours. Like, say each of my cups is twice as big as each of yours. And all of our cups are full. But so the way it shakes out is the amount of milk that I have, like the volume of milk that I have, is way greater than yours. In that kind of situation, I can truthfully say I have more milk than you do, right? Mm-hmm. But you can say that you have more milks than I do. Right. So like the ordering relation gets flipped. Who has more flips depending on whether you're talking about it as milk or as milks. So anyway, so something similar is going to happen to whether, you know, it's going to end up being important whether it's more than a feeling or more than words. So this is like exactly the nerding out that happens. And so I don't go seeking out pop culture sort of references and stuff, but I certainly receive them from a lot of people. So people see how obsessed, I guess, I am with expressions like more, and make sure that they send me all the weird examples that they find.
What about More Than a Woman by the Bee Gees?
Yeah, see, these are really interesting cases because you're not supposed to, like, it's the examples that I've heard are like, so take Alexis. Alexis is in a philosophy department, but she's a linguist. You might say of me that I'm more a linguist than a philosopher.
Right.
Those are actually really tricky cases that I personally don't know how to analyze. So, yeah, it's a good case.
All right. So now you've studied the word. Like, what would you say, what are the follow-ups to the book? Like, what do you think are the implications of the book? Like, what do you want to look into now? Like, what are the next steps here?
Yeah, so, well, the really big project for me is trying to understand how language as a cognitive faculty, so as some box, like you can think about like all your various cognitive abilities, like your ability to perceive sights and sounds and to feel things and so on. Each of these senses correspond to some faculty in your mind brain. Call them faculties. One of the faculties that you have up there is the language faculty. So it's the thing that you have in your head in virtue of which you're able to produce and understand language. Now, we can talk about what we see, and we can see things just from hearing sentences, right? So if I say to you, like, there are 64 pink elephants wearing purple tutus doing the Macarena on my dinner table right now, you know, some little movie can start playing in your head. And it's not necessarily going to be the exact same movie that's playing in my head, but it's going to be pretty darn similar. So there's a way in which language hooks up with, say, visual perception and conception, and with these other faculties. And the deep sort of scientific question here is, how does that work, right? So if you want to know, how is it that someone can say a sentence to you in a language that you understand and like a little movie can start playing in your head, that's the question that really animates my work. And it builds on the study of Moore in that once you finally want to get to explaining, say, which dimension for comparison is going to be important for a given comparative sentence, like, so for example, I drank more coffee, that's about volume or something. I bought more coffee, that could be volume or weight. I bought more coffees, that's about number. You know, Sue is more intelligent than Sam, that's about like intelligence, or et cetera, right? So the dimension for comparison, which aspect of the world you need to pay attention to in order to say whether the sentence is true or false or whatever, it varies quite widely. And, you know, one thing that a semanticist can just say is like, well, the dimension for comparison goes along with whatever the context provides, whatever the context for utterance requires. Well, that's what people tend to say. That ends up being kind of boring. What I want to do is understand that, the dimensional selection for comparative sentences as relating in a really important way to the interface between the language faculty and other faculties of mind. So I want to think about these dimensions for measurement and comparison as being grounded in, you know, just facts about how we think about objects and events and qualities and things like that. Right. So really what I'm trying to do is, yeah, study, you know, what we know about how the mind works independently of language. So looking at cognitive psychology and how that develops. So looking at cognitive development and really trying to characterize the interface between language and mind. And so this ends up being like chapter 9 of the book starts to edge into that kind of interface question. And it's what's animating most of my research now, including the NSF-funded research I'm doing in my lab in the philosophy department.
You know, something I don't think we mentioned is, what is the name of the book? Where can people find it? That sort of thing.
The book is called The Meaning of More, and it was published by Oxford University Press. I think it is on bookshelves in the UK right now, and it will be in North America in November. I should warn people, it's a fairly technical linguistics book. So, you know, if, you know, maybe check out the intro section before you like rush into it. I don't want people to get really excited that they're going to like learn all this fun stuff that I'm talking about, because it's pitched at, you know, sort of the graduate student level. But I think there is something in there for people. I've tried to write it so that you know, the descriptions of the types of sentences and what these sentences mean and how the meaning of, you know, this category relates to that category and stuff. So descriptively, I've tried to be accessible, certainly more accessible than is often the case in formal semantics. But just that warning, like it starts to get a little funny looking with like, you know, mathematical symbols and stuff at certain points.
With that in mind, Well, wait. What mathematical symbols are you using? Just like what is a mathematical symbol in the book? Just yeah, what's a mathematical symbol? Just and I know I'm not going to understand it, but I want to know, what is it?
Yeah, no. So we model the meanings in a formal language called the Lambda calculus, which those your listeners who are familiar with programming languages would be familiar with it. But so, for example. You know, I gave you the example of, we'll say like the meaning of the noun cow, or the interpretation of the noun cow is the set of cows. What you'll actually see in the book is like a meaning function applied to the noun cow has as its value lambda x dot c of x. So lambda x dot c of x refers to the function which takes an x, and then you say something about the type of x, and returns the value true just in case x is a c. In this case, C standing for cow. So you'll see that sort of thing. For me, you end up with these abstractions called degrees, which are like numbers, but they have a dimension associated with them. So you end up having these sort of lambda abstractions over these degree objects. so it's going to look kind of like logic. And kind of a dash of computer science is what the formalism looks like. Essentially, the historical roots of the tradition of formal semantics that I'm working in goes back to the same people gave birth to modern computer science. So use of the lambda calculus goes back right to the first half of the last century.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, they diverged, and so like the notations are different, but like people who are proficient in the computer science side will be able to parse it out pretty quickly. But for the rest of us, it's going to look a little opaque at first.
I guess with all that in mind, and not to judge a book by its cover, but what do you put on the cover of a technical book about the word more?
Well, you know, if it were up to me, it would just be like, I'm kind of a minimalist in multiple senses. So the dominant view in natural language syntax right now is called minimalism, but I would just have it be like this bold red color, because that's me. But I actually didn't get much of a say. So the book is part of a series called Oxford Studies in Semantics and Pragmatics, and they have a series design. So I was able to pick the color, but the design is sort of like a word cloud of, you know, that are used in the book, and then it's got this lovely red color kind
of.
Well,
you got to fit
in,
into that Oxford series of Pragmatics extended universe, or otherwise, it's, you know, how are they going to make the movie?
Exactly.
The book will be out soon. It is called The Meaning of More. Alexis, thank you so much for telling us more about the word more today on the Jeff Rubin. Jeff Rubin, see what I did there? I'm using words. I'm using my words.
I did. You're using them well. Thanks so much, Jeff. I've had a great time. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.